the Financial Sense Midweek Edition with Jim Poplava. Delving in-depth with authors and experts into the key economic issues.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's Lifetime Income Series.
And I'm John Loeffler, and our guest this week on the program will be Adam Sherry. He will be discussing charitable gifting, everything from the creation of charitable remainder trusts to outright bequests to gifts to foundations. All of that will be discussed later on in the program today. But first of all, Jim, what's the topic?
Well, today, John, we're going to cover a topic that's impacting a lot more Americans. You know, it's no secret. We have the largest retirement population in the history of this country on a demographic basis heading into retirement. But what happens, as we have talked so many times on this program, we talk about the different phases of retirement, pre-retirement phase, or let's say somebody's fortunate enough to retire early. But there's also that situation that can happen where it's not that you want to retire, you are retired involuntarily. I'm talking about the layoffs that we saw in the financial crisis, which began in 2007 and 2008. Even today, here we are 5 or 6 years into recovery, and the unemployment rate is higher than it normally is. So a lot of individuals who were not planning to retire early simply got laid off. And so the unfortunate thing is the way the tax laws are written, the government wants you to work as long as possible, because the longer you work, that puts less strain on the Social Security system. So the laws, from getting full retirement benefits from Social Security, Medicare, accessing your retirement account, all have ages that have to be met before you can access these funds or get the benefits, and there can be steep penalties if you don't. And so what we're talking about here are some critical dates of early retirement. One of them is age 59 and a half. That's when you can access the deferred gains in a Roth IRA. It's when you can access your IRA. And then we're also talking about age 62 to what could be age 67, depending on your age, when you get full retirement benefits from Social Security. So today's topic is early retirement.
And obviously, a lot of this became an issue due to the financial crisis, which erupted in 2007, 2008. It rather radically changed some of the landscape when you're planning for retirement. Let's face it, we've had the worst recession in decades, probably since the Great Depression. Unemployment rate has stayed high for quite a few years now. So you can see that the employment camp is not bouncing back. As a result, or combined with this, many companies downsized and many people were forced into early retirement for which they had not planned.
And John, this can also happen in various other ways. Let's say you're a business owner, you're, let's say, in your 50s or in your 40s. And I've seen it happen in the 40s, where somebody wants to acquire your business. And all of a sudden, you've gone from running a business to somebody cashing you out. Maybe you stay on for a couple of years during the workout period. But nonetheless, you are now entering into retirement at an age, let's say, you had not anticipated. Now, it's not just the fact that you're not going to be running the business, but you're not young enough to access a lot of the things that you may have put away for your retirement. For example, if you had your own business, you might have had a retirement plan. And we know that, for example, in retirement accounts, there's a limitation of age 59 and a half. There is a way to get around that, but don't usually prefer it. And then we also know that you can't access Social Security until age 62. And remember, if you do access it at age 62, you're not going to get the full benefits. So we see this not only for individuals that have their own company, but it's also a problem for employees that get early retirement. It's probably less of a problem, John, for business owners, because if somebody's going to buy your business, they're going to do a number of things. They're going to give you cash up front. You may be getting taken over by a public company that gives you stock in exchange. You may get a lump sum, or you may get periodic payments over a period of time that can take you up to those critical dates of 59 and a half, 62, and 66. But there are a number of reasons why somebody can be put into an early retirement situation which really wasn't planned for.
So if you have age restrictions, and they are on a lot of the implements we use to plan for retirement, Social Security, retirement accounts, what do individuals do to prepare so that they're making these dates, that these dates are in their minds, so that they understand the minefield they're sort of walking in?
Well, I mean, we always talk about retirement in three phases. Phase one is prior to age 59 and a half. Now, that can either be early retirement. You either got laid off, you were fortunate enough, you sold your company, whatever reason, you're retiring much earlier than you anticipated. Or it could be the 5 or 10 year period prior to you entering retirement, because you should be doing different things with investments, tax planning, even kids' education, location of where you're going to retire, you know, the big home versus the small home, downsizing. We call that phase one. Phase two is usually between age 59 and a half and age 62, 66, where you can have one, access to your retirement accounts without penalty, or you can have access to Social Security. Phase three, John, is what we always refer to after age 66 or 67, depending on your age, when you can actually have access to full Social Security benefits without forfeiting any of those benefits if you continue to work either full-time or part-time. So the important thing here is you need to plan for this eventuality. Business owners, as I've mentioned, have less of a problem because they're probably going to receive capital, either payments, stock, or something for the sale of their business. The bigger problem comes for individuals that are employees of corporations or an employer, and there's a number of reasons they can face early retirement. It could be, for example, layoffs. It could come about, for example, in mergers. And we see this a lot in the pharmaceutical business and others where a merger comes about and there is a downsizing of the number of employees. Or in some cases, it could be a healthcare issue, which is what we're going to discuss in today's case study. So there are a number of reasons why you enter early retirement. And John, a lot of people just aren't planning for early retirement. They're planning for, okay, I'm going to retire at age 62 or age 65, and all of a sudden, either a health issue or merger comes, or in the case of, let's say, 2007 and 2009, probably the worst recession that this country has experienced, probably going back to the 74 recession or before that, the Great Depression.
Yeah. Recognizing that there are limitations on retirement accounts and on Social Security accounts is important. It is also important to recognize that the laws tend to be skewed for the benefit of individuals who are working. What I mean here is that the government wants you working as long as possible. So just in Social Security alone, they keep pushing back the Social Security retirement date, 65, 66, 67, depending on your age group. You can see this thing creeping backwards. And there's talk about pushing it back even further. And Jim, if we ever run into any other kind of governmental financial crisis, you can see it drifting back to 70 and maybe even beyond that. So anyway, having given all of this and these changes, and that's part of the problem when you're trying to do this planning, is it's a constant moving target. It's not like something good is put in place and it sits there. There's constant tinkering going on, and that can drive you nuts after a while.
Well, John, I can tell you, you know, they push back. We've had several Social Security reforms. 1984, they raised the tax on Social Security, began indexing the amount they leveled that tax against. That was supposed to make it secure. Then in the 1986 tax reform bill, they began to tax up to 50% of Social Security benefits. Then under Clinton, they taxed 85%. Then they pushed back the retirement date. And everybody knows that at the end of this decade, we're going to have a severe entitlement issue because we'll have a larger portion of our population heading into retirement that's going to be putting strains on the system. And so we know at some point, not in this administration, but probably more likely the next president will be facing entitlement reforms. And part of that, and I've seen it in the Simpson-Bowles Act, they've talked about means testing, they've talked about pushing back the retirement age. And let's face it, John, when they put Social Security into place in 1933, you know, individuals, you know, a male's life expectancy was age 65. Today it's 85. So people are living longer. So it's only natural that they would push that retirement age further out. And I can tell you, that's going to be one likely outcome. Means testing would be very difficult because, you know, how are you going to get people to contribute to Social Security if you tell them, oh, by the way, if you're real successful, we're going to take it away from you. So one of the more likely prospects coming down probably in the next president will be that they'll push that Social Security age even further because people today are living longer. They're living 20 years longer than when they put Social Security into effect. So a natural progression of that would be basically putting people back into a situation where they have to retire later. We've seen it, John, for you and I. Instead of age 65 for full benefits, it's now 66. And for the generation behind us, it's going to be 67. So I can see them actually pushing minimum benefits at age 65, full benefits at age 69. And I've seen that proposal. So it's not out of line. But the real key here, planning for early retirement, is building up non-retirement savings. Because remember, anything you put in retirement has an age limitation of 59 and a half. So you want a pool of capital that you can access without having to go through penalties. And the unfortunate thing, most individuals, especially if you're an employee working for an employer, most individuals put the bulk of their savings into their retirement plans, 403b plans if you're a teacher, 457 plans if you're with the government, 401k plans at corporations. And this limits your flexibility, because if early retirement becomes eventuality, you may be facing penalties if you have to access those assets, everything from a Roth to your regular IRAs. So building up personal savings in a portfolio can make the difference in this phase one, so that you can rely on these savings to get you to age 59 and a half, where you can have full access to your Roth IRA deferred earnings, and you can have access to your IRAs or 401k plans without having to incur the penalties that the government imposes.
So if you're looking at this type of a situation, I think the important focus would be on the types of strategies that you can employ. You're always going to have a tax issue. Retirement plans done pre-tax, outside savings, after tax, plus your earnings are taxed. So tax is involved in the whole thing, and how you structure this is important.
Well, it's one of the reasons why you often hear us talk not only on the weekend programs, but also here on Lifetime Income, the favorable advantage of individual stocks, because they are tax favored. Depending on your tax bracket, whether you're single making over 400 or married making over 450, the tax on dividends on stocks can range anywhere from 15% to 20%, depending on whether you're in the Bush tax rates or the Obama tax rates. The other thing, too, is taxes, if you sell a stock, is taxed at a more favorable rate, a capital gain rate of anywhere from 15 to 20%, once again, depending on your bracket. And that's why you hear a lot of people like Warren Buffett, some of the hedge fund managers are in these lower brackets, because our tax laws, being a capitalistic society, favor capital accumulation. So dividends, which are taxed twice, once at the corporate level, and then once again at the individual level, have a more favorable tax treatment of 15 to 20% versus individual tax rates, which can go as high as 44%. There are other methods you can use to accumulate. You know, there's things like tax sheltered annuities. We'll talk about a government bond that is tax deferred, and also tax-free accounts also work. But there are a number of strategies you can use. The whole idea is to minimize taxes, because obviously the less taxes you pay, the more that you can defer pay those taxes, the more money you're going to have if you do face or find yourself in an early retirement situation.
Now, I know dividends are taxed at a lower tax rate versus, say, for example, interest rates. I know tax-free bonds work for high tax bracket investors. Anything else that could be done?
I mean, there's three or four different strategies you can use to minimize taxes and have access to that capital prior to age 59 and a half. One of my favorites, outside individual stocks, which are taxed at lower rates, is the Roth IRA. Now, the thing about Roth is that eventually at age 59 and a half, when you take it out, the income is all tax-free. And also, you don't have to face those minimum distributions at age 70 and a half. And John, remind me as we get to the end of this, there is a new tax law change that just came from the IRS regarding distributions from IRAs at age 70 and a half. It's very favorable. You can exempt up to $125,000. I want to mention that because we just got some IRS regs on that. But the thing about a Roth, there is no minimum distribution at age 70 and a half. The other thing, too, is the distributions from a Roth are not included in determining whether you pay taxes on your Social Security. And here's the key thing. The money can be withdrawn from the accounts anytime without any taxes or penalties, as long as the amount withdrawn does not exceed the amount put in. Now, let me explain that. Let's say, I don't know, John and Jane Doe are age 40. They're each putting $5,000 into a Roth IRA, which is the maximum you can put in. So they're putting in $5,000 apiece. That's $10,000 for both of them. They're age 40. They want to do that for 15 years. So $10,000 into a Roth IRA each year for 15 years, they would have socked away $150,000. Now, let's say that John retires early at age 55, and his wife, they could take out $150,000 prior to age 59 and a half, in other words, the amount that they put in, without any taxes or without any penalties. So this is one strategy, if you start early, could work out well. If you are one of the fortunate ones, or maybe you have an unfortunate situation due to health, or let's say downsizing, where you can retire early.
Now, aren't there going to be limitations on Roth IRAs, who can contribute to them?
Well, there is a limitation in terms of using Roth. There is no limitation in terms of Roth conversions. Right now, if you're married, the limitation is $191,000 for married, $129,000 for a single on what we call modified adjusted gross income. Full Roth contributions can be made if you're married, if you earn up to $181,000 of modified adjusted gross income. That's basically the figure on the bottom of the page at the front portion of your tax return. It's $114,000 if you're single. However, there are no limitations on Roth IRA conversions, so it may make sense if you have maybe some smaller IRAs. It's not a large amount. You can do that, and you can afford to pay the taxes. But Roth IRAs are a good tool if you are at that income level where you can afford to put that money aside outside, let's say, other retirement vehicles, because once again, you can have access to that money. You can withdraw it prior to age 59 and a half. And then at age 59 and a half, you can take out all the deferred earnings and it'll be tax free. So it's a great tool in planning, especially for phase one of early retirement. And also it can come in handy later on, as we'll talk about, when you get to age 70 and a half, because there are no mandatory distributions.
Okay, what about tax-free or tax-deferred instruments?
I mean, that's another investment strategy that can work well. One of the things that come to mind are the good old-fashioned savings bonds. The thing about a savings bond, it allows you to accumulate interest income, and it's tax-deferred. And you got a choice with the savings bond. You can either declare the annual interest and pay tax on it, so when you take it out later, there is no tax, or you can just simply allow it to compound tax deferred. And individuals in the high tax brackets may want to allow their savings bonds to accumulate tax deferred to the time that they do take early retirement, when supposedly they'll be in the lower tax bracket. Like the Roth, there is a limitation in terms of the amount that you can put in each year. For a Roth, the limit is $5,000 per individual. For savings bonds, those are the good old double E bonds, it's limited to $10,000 per year per person. Now, when we take a look at the returns, they're actually much better than what you can get in a lot of treasuries right now. There's two portions to a savings bond. There's a fixed portion, and then there's a variable rate portion that gets adjusted every 6 months on May 1st and November 1st. Currently, right now, the interest rate is roughly about 1.94%, so let's round it off and say 2%. John, that's not too much different than a 10-year treasury note, which is around 2.25%. The only problem is if you want to get access to it within 12 months, there would be some difficulty. If you want access to cash amount prior to 5 years ownership, there is a 3-month interest penalty. But after 5 years, there is no penalty if you want to cash out a savings bond. And there's also a convenient way to do that. Let's say you have, I don't know, a tax refund coming. If it's less than $5,000, you can file form 8888 or quadruple eight, and you can have your tax refund go into a savings bond. It's a great way to save and put some money aside. You don't need the money. You just put it aside. It's tax deferred, and you can accumulate some savings bonds that you can use for retirement, or once again, you can have access to them if you end up retiring early.
Well, what about tax-free bonds as far as, say, for example, people who are in high tax brackets? This would seem to make sense.
Well, the high tax brackets, obviously, you would really need to get with your tax advisor and accountant because there's a certain rate you may be better off even in high dividend paying stocks paying 15% than you would tax free. So what really comes into play here is what your tax bracket is. But another way of using tax-free income that I like planning for retirement are what we call zero coupon tax-frees. They're just like zero coupon bonds. And what you're doing is you're compounding your money on a tax-free basis. So you don't have to worry about, okay, I just got a check for my tax-free bonds. Where do I invest it? A zero coupon bond matures. For example, let's take that same couple age 40. They could put away, let's say they wanted to have $100,000 in 15 years to retire at age 55. They could put away $64,000 in 15 years from now. They would have $100,000 in a tax-free bond when it comes due, and they could cash it out tax-free. There's no penalties, and it's all tax-free income. We use a lot of this for high bracket individuals that are saving for their children's education. They're in a high tax bracket. We may put together a lot of times, you know, let's say the grandparents want to make gifts to the grandchildren. We'll set up a tax-free zero coupon bonds that mature when, let's say, junior gets to be a freshman in college, sophomore, junior, and senior. We'll have a laddered zero coupon bond strategy, but you can also do the same for retirement.
So then you talked about several strategies, tax-free bonds and incentives on zero coupons, Roth IRAs. And on the Roth IRAs, by the way, you can withdraw all of the principal prior to age 59 and a half with no penalties on that. There's a series of tax-deferred bonds. So the real question out of all of these things is, do you use a combination of strategies or just one?
Well, I mean, John, you're probably going to use several. I mean, one of my favorites is I like stocks that pay dividends. And there's a reason for that because, number one, you can reinvest the dividends if you don't have the need for income. And for most individual investors, dividends are going to be taxed at 15% tax rate. It's a very low rate. The other thing I like about dividend paying stocks is most of them, if you get a good paying blue chip stock, they're increasing the income. So the returns today, probably the first time I've seen in my over three decades in the business, you have individual stocks that are paying higher returns in terms of income than what you could get on government bonds. I mean, the 10-year treasury is around 2.25. John, you can get dividend yields of 3%, 4%, and 5%, depending on which area you're looking in. So they're not only taxed at a lower bracket, you have a higher return. And it solves a real big issue that we're starting to see in retirement now that could be a crisis for many individuals. Because the earlier you retire, the more years you're going to have to draw down your assets. In other words, your assets are going to have to carry you over a longer time frame. That's why I think that when it comes to Social Security, you're seeing the government postpone or push out the access years. A male age 65 today has a life expectancy of age 84. A woman age 65 has a life expectancy of age 87. So the problem for early retirees, if you retire before age 65, is you have that many more years to draw down your assets. And you don't want to end up being retired in an early age and find out at age 75 or age 70, you have to go back to work or work part-time because you're drawing down your assets. So the thing I like about stocks is you're building up an inflation hedge, you're building an income hedge that is going to last you throughout your retirement. And that's one of the better strategies. You know, the other things we talked about, zero coupon, tax-free bonds, series E bonds, you know, depending on how much income you have to put aside, what you can save in your tax bracket really is going to determine what kind of strategy you use. And it's something you should do with your advisor in the planning process. You may find out that just one strategy works. And depending on your risk tolerance, it could be anything from savings bonds or tax-free municipals, if you're risk adverse in a high tax bracket, to actually blue chip dividend paying stocks.
And as we do almost every week here on the program, we turn this into a practical case study using real life examples, however, changing the names to protect the privacy of various individuals. So the case study today is?
Well, this is a case study. It's somewhat unique. It's Jim and Jan Waterman. Jim was age 57. Jan, his wife, was age 53. The real key question here was a health issue. Jim was a subsidiary president of a large Fortune 500 company. And the problem is, after he had his first heart attack, what they did following the heart attack was did bypass surgery. And so the problem was he was in a very high stress job, traveling around the country to the various divisions, traveling overseas. And John, you know, it's like going from, let's say, one area of the country in California, you go to Europe, there's an 8-hour time difference. And what is it? 12, 16-hour difference to Asia. So the travel, the stress of the job. And so basically his doctor said, you know, look, you need to de-stress. You can't keep this kind of schedule. Do this or you're going to have another heart attack or possibly die. And so this was a case where health issues became a real big issue here. And so the plan was to retire early and then basically take himself out of this stress situation, regain his health, get his diet, his exercise program, get his cholesterol down with drugs and diet. So here was a health issue because he knew if he maintained that schedule, the high stress schedule that he was keeping, the flying, the time zones, that possibly he could have an early demise. So fortunately for him, he was a president of a subsidiary. And so net worth was not an issue here. We had assets that could work with. First of all, he had a home that was paid for, $2.3 million, which he paid for with exercising options. They had Roth IRAs, roughly about $70,000 in Roth IRA. He had over 12,000 shares of the company's stock, which was worth roughly about $1.8 million. The dividend yield on that stock was about 2.1%. And then the IRA, which was $2.4 million rolling over the 401k. And he had roughly about $500,000 in tax-free bonds. Their budget was roughly about $110,000, which would include $30,000 for travel. So when we look at this and we looked at his income, and, you know, folks, $30,000, by the way, if you're going to Europe, going to Asia or any place like that, is really not much, especially when you take a look at what's happened to airline tickets. So when we took a look at his budget, we had $110,000, which included $80,000 of basic living expenses and roughly about $30,000 of what I call wannabes. In other words, you know, we want to travel. We want to see our kids. We want to go places and do some of these things and do it on a non-stress basis, not having to work. So the $30,000 was sort of on the want list. But when we took a look at income, we had roughly about $15,000 coming from tax-free bonds, close to $38,000 coming from the company stock. That was roughly about $53,000 of income versus $110,000 of basic living expenses plus travel expenses. So there was a $57,000 shortfall. The other issue was one of the main assets besides the company stock, the home that they lived in, which was paid for, was also Jim's age of 57 because he couldn't really have access to his IRA unless we annuitized it until age 59 and a half. So we had a 2.5-year time frame. And so one of the solutions that we recommended was to cash out the Roth IRA, which there wasn't much deferred interest, to handle year one of retirement to make up the difference. And then the other one was they had a large house, which was paid for, and they wanted to move to a gated community that was on a golf course. They were golfers. And they wanted to basically downsize the house. They were going to go to a 5,000 or 6,000 square foot house to roughly a 3,000 square foot house on a golf course. So they were going to have a new house built, which would cost them about $1.1 million. Selling the existing house, which was valued at roughly about $2.3 million, that would free up $1.2 million in capital. So what we were going to use is the first year we were going to cover the shortfall by cashing in the Roth. And the second year, we were going to use the freed up capital from downsizing the house, freeing up some of that capital out of the home and turning that into a portfolio of not only tax-free bonds, but also low taxed income like dividend paying stocks, because they didn't want to get themselves in a high tax bracket as he was when he was a working executive. So at age 59 and a half, we had a 2.5-year time frame. Year one, the difference would be made up with the Roth IRA. Years 2 and 2.5 would be made up with the difference that would be freed up from the capital that would be taken out of downsizing their house, cashing in on the big house, downsizing to the smaller house. And from that point, he was pretty free and clear. So basically, Jim and Jan's problems, John, didn't really stem from having assets. They had plenty of assets to work with, being a corporate executive. The problem was age and health. So here was a situation where I'm sure had he never had a health issue and stress issue, he would probably work to age 65. But here, having a heart attack and bypass surgery, the advice was, look, you can't go on living, keeping the travel schedule and the stress levels, or otherwise, you know, you're going to have problems. And so here was an early retirement that was forced due to health issues. But once again, there was enough assets here. So at retirement, they were free and clear because we anticipated the IRA, which was roughly about $2.4 million, would be $2.7 by the time he turned 59 and a half. That would be roughly at 3%, $81,000 a year income. The company stock continued to grow dividends at 7, 8% would be $42,000. We would take a good portion of the assets freed up from the home, add it to the tax-free bond portfolio. That would produce $33,000 of tax-free income, which would help to keep them in a lower bracket. And then a new stock portfolio of additional stocks would be $18,000. So from that point, John, it would be $174,000. So the issues they'd be facing in the future would probably be estate planning issues, of which we had a plan that we were going to be giving gifts to the grandchildren with the excess income. So here was an issue, retiring 2.5 years before the first retirement date of 59 and a half, using a Roth IRA, cashing that out in year one, and then the equity in the house to carry him through year two to 2.5 until actually Jim turned 59 and a half.
So another successful plan and another successful execution of the same plan. If people wish to contact you, how do they do that?
Well, we make it real easy. We have a toll-free number, 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to talk to you about setting up your own retirement plan.
All right, coming up next, Adam Sherry, charitable gifting of all types and how it factors into your retirement planning. Coming up next at FinancialSense.com.
It's that time of the year when we think about giving. It's the end of the year. We're celebrating Thanksgiving and the Christmas holidays. Well, it's a holiday about giving to others. Well, what about giving charitably? That's our discussion today. Joining me on the program is attorney Adam Sherry. And Adam, you know, this is the time of the year when most people are thinking about giving. We're celebrating Thanksgiving, and that's what the Christmas holidays are all about. But there's another aspect to giving, which is charitable gifting. And I wonder if you could take us through some of the simple rules. I mean, I know that, for example, if I give to my church, or if I give to Salvation Army, or I give to some charitable organization, I can get a tax deduction. But let's talk about some of the simple rules and basics that apply to charitable giving.
Absolutely. That's a great idea. You know, there's issues as far as how to give. You know, so there's things that we need to do as far as documenting our giving so that we are eligible to receive some of the tax benefits that are associated with charitable giving. And then there's also issues that I know you're pretty familiar with, which is what to give as far as the different types of assets to give other than just cash, which can really maximize the benefit both to the person making the gift and then also to the recipient of the gift. So when I mentioned the issues about documentation, these are kind of the nitty-gritty tax issues that are often best discussed with the person who prepares your taxes, a tax professional. But some of the basics really have to do with the fact that if you're going to be making a charitable gift and you'd like to receive a tax benefit for it, one of the first things you just have to recognize is you're going to have to be itemizing those deductions on your taxes. After that, it's important to remember that while charitable giving comes in a variety of forms, it could be giving to a neighbor, giving to a person in need, the only donations or charitable gifts that we're going to be able to receive a charitable deduction for are those which, A, we can document, and B, are to an organization or a cause recognized by the IRS.
You know, this is something very important. When somebody is making a donation, like whether it's to the Red Cross, the American Cancer Society, these are sort of widely known, recognized charities. Oftentimes, individuals will make gifts, Adam, that go to something that is a smaller organization and maybe having something to do with their church? Or does the IRS publish a list of recognized charities? In other words, as you mentioned, there are key things. One is documentation of the actual gift itself. But the second one is it has to be to a legitimate organization recognized by the IRS in order to get the deduction.
Absolutely. And, you know, that's one of the things that the IRS wants to support the public in. And so there's actually IRS Publication 78, which is available online. It's actually a pretty detailed resource when it comes to this because they actually list the organizations that they recognize. Another resource when it comes to identifying those organizations, and there's a variety of them, but one that I like to use is Charity Navigator, which is just a useful database online that relies in large part on the information available through IRS Publication 78. You know, in addition to that, then, if we were to consult either of those two resources, just like you mentioned, a church, a synagogue, temple, some sort of other local organization or a school even may not show up on that list, but those are actually considered by the IRS a de facto charitable organization. So for the most part, even though those may not appear in one of the resources, they're likely given that same status. And so before making a sizable gift or even an important gift as far as you're concerned, it could be worth contacting that church or religious organization, school, and just asking them and confirming that they should be able to provide you with information as far as their tax identification number or at least confirm the fact that they are a qualified organization.
I guess if you're a charity or you're doing something charitable, is it a 501c corp? There's a certain sort of tax setup that you have to qualify. Isn't there something specific regarding that?
Absolutely. And you hit it on the head. It's a 501c3. That's the one that is the most prolific. And that's the one that most large, well-established charities will organize themselves under a particular banner. Now, there's other designations under the 501 portion of the Internal Revenue Code, which are also eligible. So I say that just because it's worth noting that even if a particular organization is not organized as a 501c3, they may still be a qualified organization for receiving donations. So if you're interested in a particular organization and you note that they don't have that particular status, it's still worth following up because, you know, oftentimes a church, they aren't organized as 501c3s, but they're still eligible for the deduction. But yeah, the 501c3 is kind of the gold standard for large public charities. But as I said, other organizations still qualify.
So if we were to make this simple, as we're getting closer towards the end of the year, somebody's thinking of making a donation. So a couple things that you would recommend. Obviously, there's IRS 78, but would the Charity Navigator just be a simpler place?
It is, actually. And, you know, I suppose that the IRS is doing everybody a service by making that information available. Charity Navigator goes the next step, and they make it easily accessible. It's a much more friendly user interface.
So we have two things. Number one, you have to document the gift. Number two, you need to check out, make sure that this is a legitimate organization that you're giving to so you can qualify for the tax deduction. Let's talk about the way gifts are made. Obviously, the easiest and simple one is what a lot of people do at the end of the year or what people do with their churches. They give cash or they write a check. So you have a written receipt. Cash is probably the easiest. But there are other things that people do. We know about people, for example, giving clothes or things to St. Vincent de Paul, or sometimes transferring an asset. Let's say I have 1,000 shares of IBM and I want to donate 1,000 shares of IBM. Let's talk about the rules when you go beyond cash. Cash is pretty straightforward. You have a written receipt. I suspect, Adam, you're going to want to write a check, not to give them cash, because how do you prove that?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, just to touch briefly on the issue of cash or checks, one of the helpful things that I know the particular church I go to does is that they are able to furnish a giving statement at the end of the year. So if by chance there was a time in which I made a hard cash donation and they knew that it was coming from me, they'll be able to document that on a giving statement, even if it wasn't necessarily made in the form of a check or an automatic withdrawal from a bank account, you know, which are much easier to document. But again, as you point out, cash or checks, those are only some of the things of value that we're able to transfer to charitable organizations. And so you mentioned another really common item, which is sharing some of the items that we no longer have a use for in our everyday life and giving it to somewhere like the Salvation Army or Goodwill or something along those lines. And those organizations are pretty good about giving you a donation receipt when you drop off your goods, whether they be clothes, a bicycle, something like that. And so it may seem unimportant at the time because of the lack of formality sometimes with which it's given to you, but it's important to keep those and then to pass those on to your tax professional, because once you get over, I believe the number is $250, additional documentation may be required. You know, but moving on past household items and cash, there's a whole variety. You know, oftentimes you'll be hearing on your favorite public radio station or something like that, or other charities will have a vehicle donation program. You could be donating appreciated assets like securities. You could donate real property. You can even donate more complex assets that aren't publicly traded. For instance, you could be giving shares in an S corp or a C corp that's not publicly traded, restricted stock, LLCs, limited partnership interests. You could even be giving things like artwork or part of your wine collection or part of your gun collection, you know, whatever these various collections are. That's a whole variety of assets I just listed. So when it comes to dealing with those assets, there's different steps that we need to take regarding the valuation. So when it comes to securities or other publicly traded assets, that's pretty easy as far as valuation is concerned. We're interested in the fair market value on the date of the donation. And maybe we could talk a little bit later about how we can get some extra bang for our buck when we donate appreciated assets like that. But just to move on, when we make donations of other sorts of assets, non-publicly traded corporations, interest in an LLC, personal property like artwork or part of a collection, that sort of a donation is going to need to be supported by a qualified appraisal. So that's worth checking in with your financial advisor, your tax professional. I know that oftentimes as an estate planner, people contact us so we can put them in touch with somebody who can help them document and establish a value for something that clearly has a value. But what's necessary is a formal way of communicating and substantiating that value for IRS purposes.
So, I mean, cash marketable securities, like most people would think of, you know, IBM listed on the stock exchange or Exxon, has a clear value on the date of gift. If you're giving something other than that, you're given valuable paintings, some valuable collectible items, or, you know, here, and you're aware of this, Father Joe, who has a place for the homeless, oftentimes picks up a car or a used car, and they make that pretty easy and they give you that valuation. So some of these charities are used to receiving items like that, and they're set up to either provide you with an appraisal or receipt. Have you found that to be the case, not only just with some of the ones that we're talking about, but many of the larger organizations that are trying to find ways that make it easier for the giver, that they're set up to do this in terms of appraisal and receipt?
Absolutely. You know, a lot of the well-organized and well-functioning charities out there, like you mentioned Father Joe's Village, other national charities or even local charities, they want to make this as easy as possible. So while I talk about the idea of obtaining an appraisal, if you have an interest in making a charitable donation of an asset that you know you may need to establish a value for, and somehow that doesn't sound attractive or a little overwhelming, it's a great idea, just like you're suggesting, to get in touch with the charity, just kind of share that with them. And oftentimes, they will take care of that. They know that they're receiving something of value, so they understand they may have to put in a certain amount of effort just to make it as easy as possible for the donor. So yeah, I've even seen this happen with some rare books recently. We had a client who wanted to make a donation of early manuscripts. He was really interested in the founding fathers, but this was something that the person, you know, it was just a passion of his. It wasn't something that he was interested in because of the financial value. So when it came to determining the value, he didn't have a ready source that he could turn to. However, he was able to work with a local charity, and they were happy to do that sort of legwork, and they found somebody who actually was featured on one of those like antique roadshow or something like that. So they were interested in helping the donor complete that charitable act that they wanted to do.
Let's talk about the extent of which you can take that deduction, because the IRS does have some limitations within the laws. Let's say that you're very fortunate, you made seven figures, or it was a year that you sold some stock and you have six-figure or seven-figure gains. You want to make that deduction. Aren't there limitations in terms of the amount that you can deduct on your tax return and the amount that you can get a deduction if there's an excess of that? Let's say I gave away $1 million, but I can't take the full $1 million deduction. Explain the limitations and what happens with the full amount of the deduction that can be taken.
Yeah, that's a great issue to bring up, because if it weren't for people raising that issue, it's not something that really comes naturally. You think, I'm making this great donation, why wouldn't I be able to deduct the entire amount from my income for a given year? And so depending on the recipient, if the value of the gift that you were making equaled or was greater than 20% of your adjusted gross income, depending on the recipient, or if it's a public charity, it could be as high as 50% of your adjusted gross income for the year. Once you get over that threshold, you won't be able to take that deduction in the year in which you're making the gift. Now, the difference between 20% and 50% is a large one, and so are the implications for your taxes. So, you know, I would recommend that as soon as you approach that 20% of your adjusted gross income threshold, you get in touch with your tax professional, you share your plans for giving in a particular year, and they will help you identify whether you're in the 20% situation, a 30% situation, or a 50% situation. To continue, you asked, is that benefit just lost then for the year? And again, this is something where the details of the situation, you should really mull it over with your tax preparer or CPA. But oftentimes, the additional value of the deduction can be taken in subsequent years.
I want to move on to another form of charitable gifting. And I've used this in the past. I can think of one particular case where a gentleman had a private corporation. He had enough wealth outside his corporation with his real estate holdings, his personal portfolio. And it came to a time, it was a privately held company, and a public company was interested in buying his C corporation. So it would be an exchange of the public company stock for his C corporation stock. So when the transaction was done, he would end up owning shares in this public company. But he really didn't need them. And what we did is, once the transaction was done, the stock was transferred to something called a charitable trust, which would provide a certain level of income to both him and his wife, as long as either one of them were alive. Let's talk about the charitable remainder trust.
Absolutely. And I feel like the example that you just highlighted is one of the best ways in which to employ a charitable remainder trust. It's interesting that the IRS is willing to recognize the gift that you're making to benefit society as a whole. And so they're interested in giving a deduction, whether it be on your income taxes under certain forms of charitable remainder trust, or a reduction in your estate tax under a different form of charitable remainder trust. But it sounds like the form that you're talking about, it's really helpful, I feel, to charitably inclined individuals, because it's as if it provides an annuity. So this gift that is made to an irrevocable trust that's specifically established with a charitable remainder clause, which in just plain English means that at some point in the future, a certain portion of the assets contributed to the irrevocable trust are going to be transferred to a qualifying charitable organization. However, in the meantime, and this could be a specific term of years, it could be, you know, 10 to 20 years, or it could also be established for the lifetime of a given person. You can include in those terms, and the IRS has blessed this, that during, let's just say it's for the remainder of a person's life, like the clients that you were working with, each year for the rest of their life, and it could be both of their lives, it could be the husband and the wife's life, they're going to receive a certain percentage of the value of the corpus of the trust, so the assets that were contributed to it. And there's some variables, whether it is a certain percentage of the amount that was first contributed to it or the amount in a given year. But regardless, whichever way you choose, you can count on receiving 5, 6, 7% of the value back each year, which is a great way of saying, I want to provide this gift to a charitable organization in the future. I need or would like to rely on a certain cash flow. And so by engaging in this charitable remainder trust, you make an irrevocable gift, and then you're able to establish this continuing income stream for a period of years or the remainder of your life.
You know, what's interesting about this, and this is why it's used so widely, is in this case, if you take a look at where tax rates are today, if you're in the upper income bracket, you're going to pay 23.8% tax on capital gains. The 20% if you're in the upper bracket plus the Obamacare tax of 3.8. So that's 23.8. Adam, you take a state like ours in California where the income tax rate can be up to 13.3. So if you add, let's just round it off and say 24% federal, 13% state, that's 37%. So let's take a large example. You have $1 million of capital gains. If you were to take those capital gains on your tax return, you would pay $370,000 in federal and state taxes. So if you donate the stock instead to a charitable trust, first of all, you're not going to lose the $370,000 in taxes. That's number one, which means you have more of your asset to provide income for you. Secondarily, you're also going to get a tax deduction on that $1 million. So you're going to reduce your federal and state taxes on top of that.
Absolutely. And that was one of the things that I mentioned at the top of the program. And I'm so glad that you were able to highlight it so clearly with this example. But it really is much more bang for your buck. And, you know, if a cash gift with the same value were to be made, those benefits that you identified, you would be losing the $370,000 if you were to take those C Corp shares and sell them and then donate the proceeds to the charity that you're interested in or even put it into a charitable remainder trust, the corpus, the total gift that you're making, has been reduced. The government has extracted the capital gains tax at that point, and you just have what's left over after that. However, by engaging in a certain amount of advance planning and working with your financial advisor to select assets that are best poised to benefit you and the charity in this manner, you're able to avoid that sort of, it could be called waste, it could be called a variety of things. Well, it's very clearly just a tax. But the IRS and the government wants to reward you for this sort of charitable inclination and your willingness to share your resources with a charity. So you really are able to retain the benefit, so 37%. Plus, you get the deduction on your income tax. So I feel like that's a wonderful illustration of how choosing the right asset to make a donation or a charitable gift with can really make it a more effective gift.
Yeah, because when you take the 37% tax savings, like in the state of California on capital gains plus federal tax, and then you take the tax deduction, which also saves you taxes, it's almost like 50% of it is saved with the income tax savings and the capital gains tax savings. And if you're, you know, maybe heading into retirement, as my one client did when he sold his business, it made a considerable difference because we had so much more assets to work with. And also, the other thing I want to point out is in many ways, you're still able to control the investments. And as the principal grows inside the trust, you don't have to worry about, for example, taking capital gains and paying gains in the tax. The only thing that you are paying tax on is the income that you withdraw, and you pay ordinary income taxes on that. But if, let's say, that $1 million donation over the next 10 years grows to $2 million, and you took a 5% distribution rate on the $1 million, so you're taking $50,000 a year. If it grew to $2 million, you're taking 5% of $2 million. All of a sudden, you're getting $100,000. So you not only haven't lost control of the asset, but if the asset grows, you also benefit from it as well. Let's talk about that, because a lot of times some people say, well, gee, if I put it in this charitable trust, I'm sort of losing some control of any appreciation of the stock or any other benefits that might accrue over time with the markets.
Yeah, I think that's a great point to raise. And that's something that, in addition to your clients raising that as an estate planner, that's one of the first things that somebody will bring up when we raise the idea of a charitable remainder trust. Because if we think about it, if we think about the facts on the ground, your client was the one who started this company, or maybe it was a family company that he may have really built up from the place where he received it. Whatever the source was, at the point that the person is interested in contributing it to a charitable remainder trust, oftentimes they have played a very active role in growing those funds. And so they still have an interest in making sure that those gains aren't lost, or, you know, even building more from that starting point. And so as soon as we tell our clients that, no, you don't have to give up control, even though you're contributing it to an irrevocable trust, you know, I feel like it really gives them a sense of continuity when it comes to a connection to the asset or the connection to the gains that they've earned. And so just like you pointed out, in a charitable remainder trust, the person who establishes the trust can actually remain the trustee. And as the trustee, he or she has the ability to allocate where the money goes, you know, subject to a fiduciary standard, so long as they're making, you know, smart and prudent investments, then that's by and large met. But they're able to continue to shepherd and be a guardian of that money and make sure that it continues to grow. You know, and as you point out, they have a personal motivation, because when it's, as you said, 5%, that increases their annual distribution from the trust. And it also increases the remainder that will eventually pass to the charity. So it's a really nice thing that we're able to highlight for our clients, that even though you're putting it into this trust, it's not like you have to give it away. You know, it's interesting. Some of the misconceptions, some of the things that our clients will raise is they have a perception that the money goes immediately to the charity, and then the charity is responsible for investing it and